From London, it's the Wider Code UK podcast, episode 8 for Friday, January 14th, 2011. This week, Wikipedia celebrates its 10th anniversary, and to document its past, present, and future, we've been running Wikipedia Week on Wired.co.uk. Joining us for an in-studio interview about the encyclopedia is its founder, Jimmy Wales, who'll be talking to Olivia about the decade he spent behind the scenes. We've also spoken to various notable characters about Wikipedia to hear what they think, including Larry Sanger, who co-founded the site, but who left a few years later. But first, it's the top stories in the news on Wired.co.uk this week. Hello, I'm Nate Langson, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me within the Wired tent this week is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Hello.
And, of course, our news editor, Olivia Solon.
Hello.
And, Olivia, quite a fun week for you, actually, meeting Jimmy.
Oh, yeah, it's been really fun. I mean, I have actually met him before in extraordinary circumstances.
Yes, dressed as a giant slice of watermelon, I think.
Well, I didn't meet him dressed as a watermelon, but I was at one point later dressed as a watermelon in his presence.
I think anyone listening to this podcast every week will think we've got a fetish for, like, dressing up as things.
We do.
You know, well, I know we do, but they'll start thinking it, and that's the problem. Well, before we get into talking all about Wikipedia, and, I mean, we've had kind of a fascinating week discovering stuff about the site that I don't think any of us actually knew. And certainly getting Jimmy in to talk about his views on it has been pretty fascinating. So we look forward to playing that interview for you all in a bit. But first, two or three stories that have been popular on the site this week. T-Mobile, Duncan, did something a bit annoying for its customers. Can you tell us about the Datagate?
Yeah, the phone network, which... in 2009, I think it was, said that it was going to be merging with Orange, uploaded a page to its help and support section, which said that it was going to be changing its fair use policy on mobile internet. It was moving from a fair usage cap of somewhere between a gigabyte and 3 gigabytes, depending on what contracts you had signed up for, down. Everybody was moved down to 500 megabytes, which is a massive, massive crash, up to 83% for the people who were on 3 gigabytes beforehand.
And the problem here for people on T-Mobile is that this wasn't technically breaching their contract, at least according to T-Mobile to begin with.
Yeah, there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing on this, and a lot of people were arguing that because this was a significant change to their contract, they should be able to get out of said contract. But T-Mobile claimed that it was just a small alteration to an add-on service; it wasn't a tangible part of the contract, and so they didn't have to let anyone get out of their contracts for it.
But T-Mobile users need not worry because they have backtracked.
There was a massive reaction on the internet. We got a stream of comments on our site. Everybody was getting very, very angry on Twitter. And a few days later, one of their vice presidents, Lisa Hardy, I believe her name is, put out a statement basically saying that they were not going to be changing anything for existing customers, only for new and upgrading customers.
So if you're on T-Mobile now and have, say, a 3 gigabyte data allowance, you're fine. You've still got it.
Well, you're fine for the moment until your contract runs out and you either upgrade to a new phone, or if you, leave and come back or something like that, then you're fine. But once that happens, then, yeah, you'll be moved down to the 500 megabytes, which is not a good thing, especially when there's so many better options available elsewhere.
But maybe by then they'll change it again.
Well, it's possible. I mean, it's moving very fast at the moment. There's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing from various different network operators on the subject of data and how much you're allowed and whether it's a fair use policy or whether you actually just get this amount. T-Mobile's an interesting one because as part of their 500 meg policy, they said that when you hit 500 megs, you would still be able to access websites and email, but not other stuff like Flash videos and downloading files and things like that.
That's a bit bizarre. So if you're on our website and we had a Flash video,
yeah,
you could
load
the site but not load the video.
Yeah,
and what if you had
stupid.
An email but with a little attachment, you couldn't open the attachment?
Little attachments are fine. It's those big ones, you know, like videos.
There's really big questions about sort of how they were going to divide up the different types of network traffic and, you know, what they were doing to identify what it was. I mean, there's probably a lot of privacy questions there too.
Well, some other things that have been private up until recently, possibly, is Lake Vostok, which for about 14 million years, I think, has been completely frozen. And Liv, why don't you tell us about the Russian
penetration experiment, drilling.
Yes.
Whatever.
Not quite as rude as it sounds. There's a team from the Arctic and Antarctic Research Institute based in St. Petersburg that has been drilling from the surface of Antarctica to a subglacial lake since 1990. And there's been a lot of people against this idea for fear of contaminating it. But at the moment, they are around, I think, 100 metres, or at least a few days ago, they were about 100 metres away from the surface of the lake, which is 4,000 metres below the surface of Antarctica. So there's a huge amount of ice, and then there's a lake kind of completely isolated, as Nate said, for 14 million years underneath all this ice. And what they want to do is dig in there and get some of the water to take some samples to find out what organisms are in there. They've found a technique that they think is going to be okay and not going to contaminate the water, which is to drill a hole, allow the water to flow up that hole a little bit and refreeze, and then the next year go in and take a sample of that ice. But there's still people, worried that we're going to contaminate a lake that has hitherto had no contact with anything for such a long time, or B, reveal lots of organisms. Some people are some of the comments we've had are people worrying that there's going to be viruses that we don't have immunity to and things like that,
or aliens,
or some people think there might be aliens as well. I mean, they've done this is all a little bit ridiculous, but they have looked at similar subglacial lakes, and they have found an incredible array of viruses, like different organisms that we've never seen before. I think a Spanish scientist called Antonio Alcami and his colleagues from the National Research Council examined water samples from Antarctica's Limnopola Lake. And they found it says several thousand species of microorganisms, many of which were not previously known to science. So it could be potentially extremely interesting.
Yeah, and certainly there's been a massive amount of interest in the story that we published last week that you wrote, actually, Duncan.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is pretty interesting. So you should check it out. I mean, are there massive implications for this, do you think? I mean, what are your thoughts on this? Are we going to discover a life that has basically been evolving for 14 million years, sort of away from everything
on
else?
On its own.
On its own, or is this just someone drilling into a lake that's been frozen a bit for a while? Well,
I mean, there's a pretty small chance that the lake is going to be completely barren, because as they've been drilling down, they've been finding microorganisms as they go. But the lake in particular is interesting because it's very, very oxygen-rich. And as a result, the organisms that live in there are categorized as extremophiles, meaning that they, you know, survive in an extreme environment. And there are several other similar situations on Earth where you end up with oxygen-rich environments. And so finding the enzymes that deal with those situations could be tremendously useful.
But it's not that it's the reason why it's oxygen rich is because there are not that many organisms that are using up that oxygen.
Oh, okay.
And that's, I think we've had that in the comment, that oligotrophic, which is how the lake has been defined.
Oligotrophic, yeah.
Oligotrophic is defined as low level of primary productivity, so low levels of nutrients and not lots of oxygen. They usually have higher oxygen levels since there is less biological productivity and less oxygen is used up in respiration or remineralization.
Well, frankly, I'm pretty excited. I want them to drill down. I would love to find some kind of fascinating new life. I mean, this is one of the things that I like about deep sea exploration, is that there is so much in the very deepest levels of, you know, seas around the world that we don't know about. We've never seen. There's new species of life living at, you know, insanely high levels of pressure that obviously has repercussions in terms of what we could find on extrasolar planets and things like this. And
particularly the likes of Titan and
exactly Titan, some of the other moons, Titan, Saturn's moon, or Jupiter's. I think Titan's Saturn.
Saturn, yeah,
yeah, and you know, obviously extrasolar planets, which we're finding more and more of every year. Cool. Okay, well, let's move on to our main feature this week, which of course is Wikipedia's 10th anniversary. And we've been doing loads of stories all week, getting comments from a lot of really interesting people talking about their views, both positive and negative, on Wikipedia. The highlight, at least for me, was hearing from Jimmy Wales himself, the site's founder, Liv. You got him to come into the office and do an interview.
About 10 years behind Wikipedia.
And we'd already interviewed him for the website where he did a Q&A over perhaps some of the more typical questions you want to ask him about Wikipedia. But in the podcast interview, we asked him about things like WikiLeaks and Quora, in addition to things like the issue of the bias inherent within the system, not inherent, the systemic bias that is in Wikipedia as a result of there being a very particular demographic that contributes to Wikipedia, which is 88% male and mostly late 20s men in the Northern Hemisphere. So how they're going to address that, which I think is really interesting.
Cool. Well, let's give the interview a play.
I'm Olivia Solon. I'm news editor of wire.co.uk, and I'm here with Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, in the week of the Collaborative Encyclopedia's 10th anniversary. Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So what does it mean for you to see Wikipedia reach its 10th anniversary and still be going strong?
Well, it's a really amazing and wonderful feeling to see Wikipedia has become so popular all around the world. We have over 400 million people a month visiting the site. We're reaching new levels of quality, and well, it's a big celebration. I just found out there are going to be over 300 different parties all around the world this weekend to celebrate the birth of Wikipedia, little community events in all quarters. Over 20 different events in India, I was surprised to hear. Wow.
Now, last week I spoke to Sue Gardner, the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation, and she spoke about the kind of challenges you faced to overcome the systemic bias within the system, which is the kind of skew that comes about from the fact that most of the contributors to Wikipedia are kind of male in their 20s and from the Northern Hemisphere. How much does this concern you?
It's a big deal. It's something that we really are focused on in the future, and in a couple of different ways. So first of all, we want to make the software easier to use in English and all the European languages to make it easier for people who aren't computer geeks to get involved and contribute their knowledge. We know there's tons of people out there who are geeks but not computer geeks, and that's really important to us. And then, you know, across, as people say, the global south, we're putting a lot of effort into making sure that people are able to contribute in their own language. So we're opening our first office outside the U.S. in India later this year to help with tech support issues, to help with PR, help with whatever they need, whatever those communities need. We want to be there to support them.
Now, you're a bit of a serial entrepreneur, so you must have an eye for startups. I wanted to find out what you think of the new kind of questions and answer service, Quora.
Well, I think it must be important because everybody's been asking about it.
Yeah.
Over and over and over. So I have an account on Quora. It seems kind of cool. Unfortunately, I don't have enough experience with it to really understand it, but it seems pretty neat. Certainly, I know my inbox is full of people following me on Quora, so I should take a closer look at it.
And are there any other kind of startups that you're seeing that you're particularly interested in that you think would be exciting?
Well, I've been a board member at Hunch, and I find what they're doing very interesting. They really are doing a recommendation engine based on input from people who play around answering quizzes and things on the site. And people seem to be enjoying the service quite a bit, and it seems to be really interesting. I mean, the things that they can... the recommendations they give you based on questions you've answered seem quite remarkable to me. So that's been interesting and fun to take part in and keep an eye on.
Now, WikiLeaks has kind of been dominating the headlines for quite a while now, and I know that there is quite a bit of confusion between Wikipedia and WikiLeaks and people thinking that you're linked in some way. What do you think of it all?
Well, of course, we have absolutely nothing to do with WikiLeaks, so that's the most important thing that we've been telling people. We're a charity creating a free encyclopedia for everyone. We're not a place for people to leak documents, so please don't send me anything. Beyond that, I'm just like anybody else in the world watching WikiLeaks, and I have some things that I like and some things I don't like about it, and some mixed feelings, I guess I would say.
Can you expand on that a bit? I mean, what do you...
Well, I think in any free society, in open societies, it's important that if people have evidence of wrongdoing, that they have a way to come forward with that, and that's courageous and something that I think is heroic. At the same time, I think just dumping large numbers of documents online carries with it a lot of risk. And so I basically echo the concerns that have been voiced by Amnesty International and Reporters Without Borders. And I would just say to WikiLeaks, they should slow down and just be really careful, be thoughtful about what you're doing. It's really, really important.
Now, I asked you for an interview for the wire.co.uk. I asked you where you think Wikipedia would be in 10 years, and you said there'd be more languages, more information, and of a higher quality. But where do you see yourself in 10 years? Will you still be travelling the world talking about Wikipedia?
That's a good question. I don't really know. I don't see any way out of it at this point, but I would like to slow down a little bit. You know, it's really exciting to me, and so I remain very passionate and very excited about Wikipedia, and in particular, I'm really excited about the growth we're seeing in the developing world, because I think that's where we're really going to have a real impact. I think we really haven't had the impact there that we're going to have. And as that next billion people, next 2 billion people come online, we're going to be there as a part of that amazing transformation that's happening in the world. That's exciting to be a part of that. So I think I'll still be doing a lot of that, but I am trying to figure out ways that I can travel a little bit less.
How many air miles do you have?
Loads of air miles on all different airlines. So it's a bit... I can be incredibly boring with my up-in-the-air conversations about such things, so don't get me started.
Do you think that video will ever form a major part of Wikipedia?
I think it will be more important in the future, but I don't think it will ever be really core to the experience. For writing an encyclopedia, text is really fabulous. It's very fluid. People can change it. They can modify it. They can update it. Video, by its very nature, tends to be more static, less collaborative, and frankly, there's not a lot of demand from the community for more video. Obviously, we can think of certain things. You know, if you're reading about a historical figure, and if we can get access to historical footage, that could be a side thing that enhances your experience. You know, but really. If you want to learn about Queen Victoria, probably video isn't going to help all that much. You should just read, and that's really more than likely, in my view, going to remain core.
Do you have any particular favorite articles?
I have a lot. I mean, obviously, you know, when we think about how we use Wikipedia, it changes all the time. So my favorite article is normally the thing I don't know about that I want to know about right now, and then I read it and I'm like, oh, that was really great. You know, I know something about whatever. In terms of you know, some fun, interesting articles, I've always enjoyed the article "Inherently Funny Words," which is about, at first it was put up and I thought it was just a joke entry, and it almost got deleted, but somebody put in lots of references. Turns out a lot of famous comedians have said that in humor, when you tell a joke, the same meaning can be in a joke, but if you use a funnier word, then the joke is funnier. And lots of comedians have talked about that phenomenon, from Jerry Seinfeld, George Carlin, Krusty the Clown from The Simpsons talked about it. So it's a legitimate article on an interesting phenomenon. And, well, it's kind of amusing to read, too.
So what kind of words?
Badger. See, it worked. You laughed.
Now, we've got a couple of questions from our Twitter followers, the @WiredUK Twitter account. So the first is from MacWestUK, and he asked, do you feel that your creation has replaced the need for conventional encyclopedias? If so, how do you feel about that?
Well, yeah, I think to some extent. I mean, just not basing on my opinion, but the opinion of the world. I mean, people are using Wikipedia a massive amount, and they're buying encyclopedias of the traditional sort a lot less than they used to. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I feel good about it. I'm happy that people are enjoying what we're doing and that we're doing something that people find valuable. At the same time, I'm a bit old-fashioned and I do love the encyclopedias. And so, you know, it's sort of the passing of an era. So I'm certainly not gloating with glee or anything like that. I think encyclopedias are lovely. So.
And this is another question from Ben J. Martin. He asked, how annoying was it when you wanted to look something up and you saw your mug glaring at you for the whole of December?
It was pretty annoying. Although there's a little X, and if you click the X, I go away. So people should do that. But it was interesting because for the fundraiser this year, we had the most successful fundraiser ever. We raised more money in a shorter period of time than we'd ever done before. And one of the main reasons was the banners that we used. And before we started the fundraiser, the staff asked me, they said, well, we're thinking of using a banner with your picture on it. Is that okay? And I was like, really? Not so sure about that. And then they did some testing, and they found that it wildly outperformed all the other banners. And so I reluctantly agreed to it. And yeah, it was slightly annoying, but it worked. And so I'm happy about that. I'm happy that we managed to get the money that we need for another year of operation.
So your face is worth $16 million.
I don't know about that. Maybe people wanting to get rid of my face is worth $16 million, but...
Did people flag up some of the kind of humorous juxtapositions of your face and the message on the banners with some of the articles?
Yeah. There was one, I think it was scopophobia, fear of being stared at, was one of my favorites, and there's me staring at people. There was a lot. It was actually interesting because it did become kind of a meme, people making parody banners and things like that. Most of it was very good-natured, and I didn't mind. Of course, there's always a few mean people, but mostly it was fine.
Excellent. Those are my main Twitter questions. I had one more question I wanted to ask. Have you ever tried to work out how many volumes of printed encyclopedia the articles on Wikipedia would take up?
Yes, but I don't know the answer to that currently. It's a lot. It's a huge stack of books. There was a guy who did kind of an art project where he made a book that was meant to represent the full printed Wikipedia, and that was, massive, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet high, but I think it was even said that this wasn't really big enough to really represent Wikipedia. The other one that I saw that was really fun and interesting is a guy who made a 10-volume book set as an art project on, it was just our entry on the Iraq War, but instead of just being that entry, it was every change to that entry since it started, many years ago now. And so it showed how that entry changed over time, and it was amounted to 10 volumes. It's really interesting to think about that people wrote a 10-volume book set in order to get the one article which we have today. It's fascinating.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. Those were all of my questions.
Fabulous.
Cool. What a good interview. I love it. I'm so pleased you actually mentioned the weird juxtapositions. The Jimmy staring at you on a page about people who are afraid of staring. Love
yeah,
it.
That is brilliant. Apparently they dubbed it internally Operation Jimbo Stare, the campaign, the fundraising campaign, which is quite amusing. But I know a lot of people were commenting on it on the interwebs. So.
It'd be quite weird, though, I have to admit, if I put my face on every page of Wired.
Well, it's on some of them.
Yeah.
I know it's on some of them, but all of them asking for money.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we've also been speaking to various people this week. We've got a piece on the site with comments, quite a long piece, actually, with comments from various people. I mean, who were you speaking to, Liv? Or in fact, both of you did this.
Yeah,
this
we
piece.
Did it. Joint, we did it together, yeah.
Joint piece.
Well, we were trying to get a really wide range of opinions. So we spoke to loads of people within academia. We spoke to people who would be particularly opposed to Wikipedia. We spoke to contributors. But I think some of the, the more incendiary comments were made by some clear opponents. I know you spoke to Larry, well, not opponents, sorry, that's not fair.
Yeah, it's a bit harsh to call Larry Sanger an opponent because he founded the thing with Jimmy Wales in the first place. Yeah, Larry Sanger, as I think you said earlier, he founded the site with Jimmy Wales, and then he left a couple of years later after the funding for his position was withdrawn, and then he felt like he couldn't do it as a volunteer in his spare time. He couldn't do the position justice. But since then, he's come to be a little more. He's come to sort of embody more of an opposition perspective. He founded a rival site called Citizendium, which I think he isn't doing so much with anymore. But that was more about making sure that there were experts to verify content that people had submitted. So
it was more like a traditional encyclopedia.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
Experts writing about things they know about from a professional perspective.
And one of the most interesting things he said, we asked him how Wikipedia could be improved, and he he thought that it would be really nice if the experts would, or anybody would give, would be able to rate and review versions of articles, mm-hmm. and there'd be a way of saying this version of the article is superior to this one, rather than this is the most recent one, which is what you have currently, and that's just
or
reverted if it's
not
good.
The most popular one within the community.
Well, yes, exactly, and also to. Get more of a the only way you can comment on Wikipedia at the moment, he said, is if you actually participate. So you have to be an editor and have an account on the site to be able to comment on whether it's any good or not. And he reckons that it's become difficult to participate in for reasons that I think Jimmy explained a little bit in his interview about, and what they're trying to do to address that. But yeah. I thought that was a really interesting perspective. And there was also some good stuff from Robert McHenry. Is that right?
Yes. Now, Robert McHenry, I think it's fair to say that he is a clear opponent. He is the former editor-in-chief of Encyclopaedia Britannica. He said, Britannica was dealt a heavy blow early on by Encarta, not because Encarta was any good, which it wasn't, but because it was free, or effectively free. Now Wikipedia is free. It is very hard to conduct a for-profit business against competition that gives away its product, however inferior. So, I mean, obviously, Encyclopaedia Britannica has been really hit. But one of his most interesting points, which I think is one a lot of opponents of Wikipedia's kind of strongest opinion, is this. He says, the fatal fallacy in the Wikipedia theory is that a Wikipedia article can be thought of as an open source project, like those that produce software, and that, like those, it will undergo steady improvement towards an ideal state. But he kind of explains that software, you can kind of clearly, it's clearly identified as in development while it is open source, and it's constantly tested against objective criteria, so you can test whether it performs well or not. But the article is published to the world in whatever state it may be, and it changes daily, for better or for worse, at random times, and is held to no standard that the user can rely upon. And I think that is a valid argument. But hopefully they're trying to address that by getting more academic outreach and getting more of more experts involved.
Which needs to be the future, really,
yeah.
For any encyclopedia. I mean, so I guess talking about the future for Wikipedia, I mean, it's been around for 10 years, and certainly based on what Jimmy was saying just now, it's going to be hopefully around for another 10 years. One of the things that really struck me when we were doing a lot of this research is how similar the early days of the Oxford English Dictionary, how similar those early years, rather, were to Wikipedia's current years. So the Oxford English Dictionary has been going since sort of the mid to late 19th century. And when that was first in when it was first being compiled, it was completely volunteer driven. So there was an editor called Murray, Professor Murray, and he was sort of acting in Oxford, collating a massive amount of information about words which were being sent to him by volunteers. They were effectively strangers, basically looking at words in books, writing down on these sort of standardized little slips of paper a lot of metadata, basically, about what these words meant, where they first appeared, their context, the meaning of these words based on the context. And then they would send these slips of paper to him, and he got, you know, hundreds of thousands of these. They would compare the different meanings for words that were the same when they were submitted from different sources, from different people, and then kind of a meaning derived from all of those submissions were entered eventually into the dictionary. But if you think about it, that's kind of the same way as Wikipedia runs now, which is just a massively crowdsourced initiative. Where it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter whether you have professional qualifications. Murray was advertising for submissions, you know, in sort of post offices and shop windows and things like that. You know, do you want to be a part of this? You know, you request books and you go through these books and you send in your answers. It doesn't matter who these people were. It was basically just the first massively crowdsourced literary initiative.
And some were quite odd people, weren't they?
There were some odd people. I mean, the most notable was a chap called William C. Minor, William Chester Minor. And he was actually institutionalized in the Broadmoor Asylum for basically not criminally insane, but he was an ex-US Army surgeon and was incredibly paranoid, suffered from a range of disorders, the most notable being paranoia, and accidentally shot somebody. He shot the wrong person. He thought people were coming after him, and he shot this guy called Merritt in South London, I think, somewhere
Sounds
near.
Like he intended to shoot him.
He intended to shoot someone who I don't think was really there. He always thought his room was being invaded by people. Anyway, he shot this person, but because of his service in the war, and he was basically determined to be not guilty because he was insane, and he was put in this asylum for the rest of his life. And for 20 years, he was contributing to the Oxford English Dictionary, and Murray had absolutely no idea who this guy was, but his contribution
He just got the slips, I guess.
He just got the slips from this effectively anonymous person who had this massive repository of books that he was allowed to keep in his hospital room.
Lots of time on his hands.
Loads of time. And so the Oxford English Dictionary, for the first most notable 20 years of its life, this guy was contributing with, basically from an asylum. But I think that if, given that's how it started, and now obviously OED is very much a different operation to what it was back then, it's had, like 150 years to become what it is today. Wikipedia has been going for 10 years, but they both started out the same way. And I kind of think that, maybe in 100 years' time, obviously as technology evolves, we could possibly see with Wikipedia for human knowledge what we saw with the OED in the English language. I think it could be, amazing to think that that's what it'll become.
I suspect it'll be possibly even sooner than that.
Yeah,
I think it's moving
definitely.
Very, very fast. And we had one really, really interesting perspective from a chap called Robert Eagleston, who's a professor of contemporary literature and thought at Royal Holloway University. And he sort of came at it from an academic point of view and was describing how, obviously, for most of the last 10 years, the academic community has been very suspicious of Wikipedia because it's not checked by any of the, traditional scholarly systems that exist in the world, and that the contributors are anonymous, as we were saying just now. But more recently, there's been far more people getting involved from the academic community. There's been a bit of a sea change because not necessarily because the information on Wikipedia has become better, but because Wikipedia has kind of created its a new place within the world of information, where students and he says and many academics look to do what they're sort of starting to refer to as pre-research, mm-hmm. trying to find out the kind of thing that you'd maybe do from your professor before. You'd ask them where to get information about something. Now you look on Wikipedia, you see what the sources are, you then investigate those sources. It's a really sort of crucial thing, and it's a great benefit, according to sort of what he was saying, based on some surveys and statistics about it.
And I think similar to that, I've heard of evidence of academics giving students or themselves, just instead of seeing Wikipedia as not credible,
something
to go in and improve upon, and giving students that as a paper or as a task to do as part of their studies would be to go and improve upon
make
an
it
article.
Better.
Yeah,
get some good sources.
And of course, the OED's had many revisions. I mean, they're working on, I think, the third edition now, which may not even make it to print. And, they are sort of moving in a very similar direction, I think, in terms of being eventually academically appreciated.
Accepted.
I guess.
Yeah.
Accepted, the same way that the dictionaries have. Well, let's just before we finish up, we, of course, asked our Twitter followers and readers what Wikipedia means to them and some of their opinions. We've got three or four particularly interesting perspectives. Liv, why don't you read a first couple from our Twitter users?
First couple. So @Kate_Alex said, "Don't treat Wikipedia info as absolute, but I can't live without it. Though, like most, I'm a bit tired of the JW ads." Well, they've gone now. They've raised the money.
They put the 10-year anniversary ones up instead.
They have. And then next, they're going to be doing outreach for new contributors.
Okay.
So heard that here first.
Keep your eyes open.
And then the second one is from at Fiel Books. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. "Love going on Wikipedia journeys from link to link and finding out weird stuff, but wouldn't rely on it."
I have to say, that has got to be the thing that I do most. Generally with bands and albums, what I love doing at the moment is whenever I buy a new album or a really old album, is listen to it while reading a Wikipedia article about that album. And I just find that it's kind of cements what I learn. It's not something that I would ever use in kind of a research way, but just a kind of background to get a general feel.
Is it not something you'd use in a research way? I would.
As a source, maybe, in exactly the same way that Duncan said.
Not as a, you'd look at it and then look at the papers it's linked to.
Just for background knowledge.
Well, that's what @MacWestUK, who's a reasonably frequent contributor to our Twitter account, he said that, Wikipedia outsources the task of preliminary research on a topic to the rest of the internet. To use it as more than that is dangerous, he said. I'm not sure about dangerous. That's perhaps a little overstating the case.
Yeah, inviting murderers to dinner is dangerous. I'm not quite sure it's in the same vein.
And then
I'm definitely not going to pronounce this, Ali Al Sawaf, maybe, said, it's very useful. It's probably the most frequent page I visit. I've had it bookmarked since it launched, and sometimes I check entries to do my job, just to check accuracy, and it hasn't let me down once.
I hope he's not a doctor.
No, but actually, I think some of the more things like medicine and, you know, anatomy and things like that can be a bit more easily verifiable are actually the best place to start. As soon as you get into politics and any kind of place where there's a difference of opinion, that's where it has a lot of problems.
So objective stuff with absolute answers, as opposed to
a lot of the very hard science and maths,
or at least
the equations
kind of
and everything.
At that time, they are absolute before the next discovery.
Have we got another bit of feedback?
We have one last one from Nathan Heathering, who said, I still haven't forgiven Wikipedia after removing the, all in capital letters, excellent fan page for my college five-a-side football team in 2004. Team Louis.
Yeah, go Team Louis.
Go team.
Right. You can't add a page about yourself, but you can call upon podcast listeners to go and make one. So go and make one for, who is it? Team Louis.
Team Louis.
I'm sure they're great.
And Nathan Heathering.
Or maybe there's a reason they got kicked off Wikipedia. Maybe they're just not notable.
Well, because you're not allowed fan pages. That's one of the...
Maybe they did something great. Well, they appeared on the Wired UK podcast, so there we go. Yeah. There's
they
a
can,
reason
they
to
can
be
reference
on.
Us now.
They can. Cool. Well, I think that wraps up the show for this week. Of course, everything we've talked about, and well, actually, there's a lot of stuff that we talked about that you can't find on the website. That's why it's in the podcast. But there is a hell of a lot of information that you can find on the website.
Background information.
Yeah, on wired.co.uk. If you, at the moment, it's on the homepage as Wikipedia Week. But obviously, a search for Wikipedia as well will bring up quite a lot in the little handy search bar at the top. You can get in touch with us at podcast@wired.co.uk. And of course, follow us on Twitter. We are at wired.uk. Liv is at Olivia_Solon. And Duncan is at Duncan Gear. I'm at Nate Langson. It's so predictable, isn't it? Thanks, Duncan.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Liv.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.